This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This weekend, the hashtag Where Are the Children was all over social media, and it's a story we reported on a few weeks ago here at The Takeaway. But we need to make some clear points. There are actually two stories that have to be broken down. The first is about 7,000 children who came to the United States without their parents. Many of them were fleeing drug cartels, gang violence, and domestic abuse, and coming from Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. Officials at the Health and Human Services Department, which oversees refugee resettlement, testified before a Senate subcommittee earlier this year that they had placed 6,000 of those kids with sponsors. 28 ran away, 52 were living with a non-sponsor, and 5 were removed from the country. But those officials also said that they were unable to account for roughly 1,500 of those kids, meaning the agency, in their follow-up calls, said they couldn't determine where they were. Then, in a separate story, you have this new policy by the Trump administration.
If you're smuggling a child, then we're going to prosecute you. And that child will be separated from you, probably, as required by law. If you don't want your child to be separated, then don't bring them across the border illegally. It's not our fault that somebody does that.
Under this new policy, hundreds of undocumented migrant children, largely from Central America and the southern U.S.-Mexico border, have already been separated from their parents. And in some instances, the parents are given no information about where their child is. Lee Gelernt is a deputy director at the ACLU Immigrants' Rights Project. Lee, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So we have two separate stories here. It's really critical that we define what these two stories are. Are any of these children actually missing?
Right now, we don't have any solid evidence of that. What we have is evidence that the sponsors simply don't want to talk to the Trump administration. So the missing children thing is a little bit misleading in that the children are not just simply walking around missing. It's more likely that their sponsors just don't want to talk to the Trump administration.
Now, let's say some of these children aren't with sponsors. I mean, what is the U.S. government's responsibility if kids come across the border unaccompanied?
Right. We absolutely have a responsibility to these children legally and morally. But right now, what we're concerned about is that people misunderstand the process. There is a strong vetting process to make sure that kids are put with a sponsor that's going to take care of them. That's happening. We'd hate to see misinformation go out that then allows the Trump administration to say, well, we're going to keep holding the kids for months and months and months and not release them to sponsors on the false assumption that the kids are actually missing.
Now, this, again, is a separate group of kids that is not the kids that we're talking about under this new guidance from Attorney General Jeff Sessions. And Sessions, we heard earlier, is basically saying that children who are brought across the border will be separated from their parents. Is this a new policy or is this a strengthening of former policy?
No, it's absolutely unprecedented. The systematic separation of parents and children, including children 1 year old, 2 years old, 3 years old, is absolutely unprecedented. And I think there's two critical points in response to what the Attorney General and Secretary Nielsen are saying. Their soundbite is, if you don't want your children taken away from you, don't cross the border illegally. Two questions are never asked as follow-ups to the Attorney General and the Secretary. One is, you say if you don't want your child taken away, don't cross the border illegally, present yourself at a port of entry. Well, the ACLU has a lawsuit now challenging family separation that's going to be decided any day. It shows that many, many parents are presenting themselves at a port of entry legally, asking for asylum, and still having their child taken away from them. Our lead plaintiff is a Congolese mom who presented herself at a port of entry with her then 6-year-old daughter. After 4 days, the daughter was ripped away from her. The mother could hear the daughter in the next room begging, pleading, please don't take me away from my mommy. Please don't take me away from my mommy. She was sent to Chicago. The mother was kept in San Diego for 4 months. The mother was given no information about why the little child was taken. This is a parent, like many other parents, who presented themselves at a port of entry. So it's simply not true that you can avoid having your child taken from you if you present at a port of entry. The second critical point that no one ever asked the Attorney General or Secretary Nielsen is, well, what happens when the parent gets out of jail after the few days for the misdemeanor? Is the child returned? And the answer is no. Our other named plaintiff goes by Miss C. She crossed the border with her son, fleeing domestic violence in Brazil, crossed the border, got time served for the misdemeanor. Her child was taken away and sent to Chicago. She was in Texas. She was released from criminal jail. It's been more than 7 months since she was released from criminal jail and still has not gotten her child back.
Do we know how much this is costing Americans, the taxpayer?
That's a very good question. We are in the process, I think, of calculating how much it will cost. But ultimately, the fundamental question has to be the sort of humanity of what's going on. I think that if policymakers could sit in one of those rooms and see these little kids, 3, 4, 5 years old, begging not to be taken away from their parents, it would lend a real human dimension to the debate. Right now, I fear that the debate over immigration has gotten very abstract, and people need to see these little kids begging not to be taken away from their parents to sort of have a full understanding of what this policy is doing.
I want to also talk about the images that were also making the rounds this weekend along with the hashtag. It was quickly pointed out, as social media tends to correct itself, that those were images. The images I'm referring to are children sleeping in cages on the floor with a small mat. It turns out that these images were, in fact, from the Obama administration, which also had very strict policies. Can you tell us a little bit about what the Obama administration's role and legacy was with this?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm glad you asked that because I think, again, they're separate stories. And so we have always been troubled by the way Customs and Border Patrol, CBP, treats children. The difference, though, is that the Obama administration, nor any other administration, has ever engaged in the separation of children. So it takes it to a whole new level. The Obama administration was not systematically separating children. Was CBP abusing children during that period? Yes, we've always been concerned about CBP abuse. But what's new and shouldn't be confused is the Trump administration of separating children.
Lee Gelernt is a deputy director at the ACLU Immigrants' Rights Project. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me and shining a light on this important issue.
The practice of separating children from their parents in the United States is not new, but one historian says that in order to understand what's happening today, we need to understand our past. And to help us take this necessary look back, we are joined by Martha Jones. She's the Society of Black Alumni Presidential Professor and a history professor at Johns Hopkins University. Professor Jones, welcome.
Hi, Tanzina.
As the outrage over immigrant children being separated from their families grew louder, you decided to come in with some history about the past. Tell us why. What was missing?
I woke up Saturday morning with a feeling that people were somewhat naive in their reactions to the proposition that the United States would separate parents and children as a policy matter. As a historian, I knew that those sorts of practices were more American than we might think.
And when we say they're more American, how far back do they go?
Well, they certainly go back as far as the early 19th century, which is to say the institution of slavery is a vivid example of a period, a long period, during which on the auction block, literally and metaphorically, parents were separated from children by slaveholders, but with the authority of the state, with the protection of the state behind them.
Do we know enough about this in our history classes? Are we taught the impact of this?
Well, one of the things that has been interesting to me is how surprised people are to learn about this dimension of the enslaved experience. We emphasize the cruelty of slavery as physical punishment, for example, as forced labor. And less often, I think, do we appreciate the ways in which enslaved people indeed are making families and building communities and feel at tremendous risk always of having those relationships disrupted. One of the most moving pieces of evidence are the hundreds, really thousands, of newspaper ads that former slaves place after emancipation in 1865. Historian Heather Ann Williams has written about these advertisements in which parents and children, siblings, spouses place advertisements in local newspapers searching for people that they've been separated from even for decades. To me, the most arresting detail in Williams' study is that these ads continue to appear in the newspapers until 1902. And so here we have this vivid sense of the depth of family ties and the trauma, if you will, of having been separated involuntarily, violently, and in many cases irrevocably from one's family.
And there also is the example of Indian boarding schools, correct?
Yes. So these are institutions, some of which date back all the way to the 1840s, and some of which continued into the 21st century, where by coercion, by force, by subterfuge, Native parents were persuaded to give over their children to state-run institutions. These were institutions that were intending to, if you will, assimilate, anglicize Native peoples into another version or vision of Americans. And we have today even survivors of these institutions and their really arresting testimony about the sort of cruelty, the inhumanity to which they were subjected.
But Professor, this also seems to go against directly against what the United States is supposed to stand for in many ways, particularly now, right, with this idea of family and what's important. How do you reconcile those two things?
Well, I'm not sure we can reconcile them, and I think that's part of what the outrage that we're hearing from many Americans is rooted in. How is it that we are a nation, on the one hand, that has built itself on the family as a social institution, as an intimate institution, the family as an economic institution?
But do we only support the family, white families in this country? Is that the message that we're getting?
I would say oftentimes this is a story that breaks down along racial lines, and families of color have been on the other side of this equation. But I've just read a new book by historian Hidetaka Hirota called Expelling the Poor. And what Hirota tells us is that even for Irish immigrants in the early part of the 19th century, in those stories also, the state was responsible for separating families from children.
Martha Jones is the Society of Black Alumni Presidential Professor, a professor of history at Johns Hopkins University, and her forthcoming book is called Birthright Citizens, A History of Race and Rights in Antebellum America. Professor Jones, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.